Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. This week's episode is special in a number of ways. For one, it was recorded face-to-face with my guest back when people could do that sort of thing. And also, it's with a writer and producer whose work has been hugely influential on literally millions of people, myself included, even if he never expected that to happen. That would be Ed Solomon, a writer, producer, and occasional director who worked on Laverne and Shirley and its Gary Shandling show before moving into features among the Men in Black, Charlie's Angels, and the Now You See Me films. But perhaps his greatest contribution to humanity was the creation, with his writing partner Chris Matheson, of Bill S. Preston Esquire and Ted Theodore Logan, the cheerful idiots made immortal by Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And now, after almost three decades, the band is getting back together for Bill and Ted Face the Music, in theaters and available on demand this Friday, August 28th. Ed picked Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the 1975 feature that let Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin run riot over the Arthurian legends for an hour and a half, bringing the sensibility of Monty Python's Flying Circus to the big screen and creating one of the greatest comedies ever. And yes, it's a gateway into a longer conversation about Ed's own work, just like all the best episodes of this show. So let's get into that. This is Someone Else's Movie.
I grew up worshiping at the altar of comedy and not knowing why. My dad and I used to sit and watch movies and laugh, and maybe that's why. It was something my dad and I bonded on. And initially we started with Woody Allen, not knowing that he would become Woody Allen. I remember my dad saying, "Remember that guy with that movie that we liked that made us laugh? He's got another one. You want to go see it?" And another one was Sleeper. We had just seen, I think, Take the Money and Run.
Okay.
I'm not picking Woody Allen. I'm going to say Monty Python and the Holy Grail because it was the first time, now that I had started being interested in comedy, that I realized that there were people out there changing the form, you know, doing things that were ridiculously silly but also incredibly intelligent at the same time. I had no idea who they were. We watched... I didn't do it with my dad. I remember it was on PBS, and I didn't know anything about it, and I'm not even sure that it was somebody turning me onto it, but I stumbled on it.
Right.
And I saw this sketch, and funnily enough, I think it was the full frontal nudity one, because there were, like, first of all, it was boobs. And I was like, wait, there's boobs on TV. It was PBS, but... something drew me into it, and I was looking and going, without context, oh my God, I don't know who these people are, but I have a feeling they're going to change my world. What is this? Because it was just random sketch I came in on, and then I started watching it, and I went, I've never seen anything like this. It's really brilliantly funny. It's utterly absurd. It's ridiculous. It's silly. What is this? I have to find more of it. And so I watched a few, you know, suddenly like, oh my God, did you see this thing? What is it? It was, no one had heard of it. It wasn't the movie yet.
Right.
It was the TV show. And there's more? You know, it's a group? They're a group? What is that? I remember watching some more, and then... what year did Holy Grail come out?
75.
So, okay, yeah, that's about right. Watched whatever I could find on PBS. Of course, there was no VCR. There was no way to find it in the library. There was no internet. There was nothing. It was just waiting until this thing comes on again.
Yeah, that was my experience of it as well. It's like, I think that was real, and I'm going to wait to see it and make sure.
Yeah. Holy crap, there's another one. It's just as good. Oh, my God. And not every sketch is successful, but
there was one in every episode. There was always
at least one, maybe more, sometimes a couple, but also they were structured so strangely. Suddenly they're in one and the titles run, you know, 6 minutes in, that it blew my mind what they were doing. And then Holy Grail comes out, and I think it was the second time, the first movie that I saw repeatedly was Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, where I couldn't believe what they were doing. You know, and again, they were breaking the fourth wall as well.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of Blazing Saddles, suddenly it's modern, you know, they break out of the studio, the big fight, they're suddenly, I didn't realize you could do that. I was 12, 13. When was Blazing Saddles? 73?
74.
74. Okay, so. 74.
But yeah, I remember being just as stunned by that too.
Yeah. So I'm 59. So I was, first saw Python, I want to say in 73 or 4. I was like probably a freshman in high school because I was just making Super 8 movies. And I was experimenting with comedy and with my voice. We were making tapes, you know, we would make cassettes. And you know, I remember one of my early sketches from, I think I was 10, was called Who Stole the Bean Dip, that I did with my friend Warren Bross. The first movie that knocked me onto my knees was Blazing Saddles, where I think, and I'm embarrassed to say, I think it was the farting scene around the campfire. I couldn't believe that they would do that. Yeah. It made me laugh so hard that I fell out of my seat, saw it probably every day in the theater for a couple of weeks. The second movie I did was Holy Grail, and that changed me even more, because what we were just talking about, Holy Grail I saw repeatedly for, you know, for a series of, I don't know, just saw it.
Weeks, months, weeks, years.
Yeah. You know, had it memorized, would do it with my friends. I had my friend Lance from high school, a guy who I, you know, still friends with, but I really looked up to. I remember going to him and going, what is this thing? And he goes, what do you mean, what is this thing? And he started doing, you know, sketches after sketch, just he had to memorize.
So what was the experience of it the first time you saw it? Because I came to it backwards. I actually knew someone who had the script book first. Uh-huh. So I read it and was...
How did it read?
I mean, it's mostly on the page. It may have simply been a transcription, ultimately, in the
right.
end.
Well, no, they don't ad-lib, and they consider themselves writers first. Mm-hmm. They would write for each other, assign roles, and really perform it as written. They were not improvers.
There wasn't a lot of deleted material, which is what makes me think. Like there was it had the longer versions of the Cancel Asterix scene. It had stuff that showed up later. You know, like it read like the film that I ultimately saw. There wasn't a lot of fat on the script.
Right.
But I remember being, it might have even been my first experience of a screenplay, because it was basically printed script pages with photographs and doodle. You know, the Holy Grail script book was this big trade paperback foolishness. It was really fun, and had lots of pictures, and it was very vivid, and there was all sorts of stuff that didn't make sense visually. And reading the script, you could find the flows of the jokes that were. I mean, the wordplay was all there. It's I think the thing I remember most vividly is the line, "Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here," which is so weird to see printed out. And that got me, like, by the time I saw the film, I knew right. I knew how it worked, but I didn't know the rhythms of it, and I didn't know how the deliveries went, and it was just so, it was like it was reverse engineered in my head as I was watching it.
Right.
But to see it cold without foreknowledge, that's one of the only times I've gone into a movie knowing, like, literally everything
right.
that happens. And I was a kid, and it was fine. I handled it. But yeah, to see it knowing what Python was, but then to experience that sort of unmodulated version of it, where it just bombs at you for 80 minutes and just hits you with ideas and visuals. And it's so punk. It's so anarchic. How did you handle it?
But it was punk. What it was for me was, oh my God, they don't care about standards of format. They don't care about what's come before. They're using everything as fodder to do whatever makes them laugh. They're clearly following their own drummer here. You know, I mean, you have two guys from Oxford, or from Cambridge, Cleese and Chapman. You have three guys from Oxford, I believe that's correct.
And a rogue American.
Michael Palin and Eric Idle and Terry Jones. And then, I should know how Gilliam got involved. So you have David Frost, who puts them together. You guys should meet these guys. I think they're all going to write for the Frost Report.
Yeah, I think so. And it was after Beyond the Fringe, right? So there was some awareness of this growing new wave of comedy.
Well, and there was the Goon Show prior to that. Peter Sellers. And which was a real antecedent to Python. You can see when you look at some Goon Show stuff, you can see the Python standing on the shoulders of the Goon Show.
I used to listen to that on the radio as a kid. They broadcast them in Toronto late night. I think it was Saturday nights. There would be an episode of some old Vincent Price horror radio show, mm-hmm. and followed by the Goon Show. And the Goon Show was the thing that just.
That was Marty Feldman, right?
It was Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, and Harry Secombe. I'm not sure if Feldman. Wasn't a regular. He might have been involved with it.
What was Feldman on then? Maybe the Frost Report. I think it was on the Frost Report. But yeah.
But yeah, you're right. The anarchy is there. The sense that anything goes. There's a. What was the line about? Something about. This weird exchange about Eccles, the idiot character from. Mm-hmm. Who is like really clearly a setup for a Gumby.
Right.
In Python.
Oh, okay.
Saying, you know I'm educated, I'm wearing a Cambridge tie. You were at Cambridge, what were you doing there? Buying this tie. And that is Python, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also that cutting of the intellectuals and the class thing, it's all in there.
Well, it was, you know, here's Socrates and whoever, Descartes, I don't remember who were the characters, but, and then, you know, we're going to put them, you know, playing soccer with each other. It was these bizarre juxtapositions of the absurd and the intellectual that and the silly and the ridiculous, and the sense that, you know, they had the fish slapping dance, you know, where there's no value other than it's unbelievably ridiculous and funny, mm-hmm. and you laugh. It was a moment for me where I went, oh my God, I wouldn't even have the gumption to say there are people that see the world like I see it, because I didn't know that that was even possible, but oh my God, there's people that are seeing the world in the way that I wish I could. Yeah. And in fact, they always were, and I never succeeded at it, and never will succeed at it. They were my model for, you know, what do you want to do with yourself as a writer? You know, I want to change comedy. I want to do my own version. I never did. I never could. I never had that ability. I just don't have the skills for that. When Chris Matheson and I wrote Bill and Ted first, Monty Python was a gigantic influence for us in terms of just, we wanted it to feel like Holy Grail. We wanted the rough edges. In fact, our production designer was Roy Fort Smith, who designed Holy Grail. And we were so excited that we were going to have a piece of, you know, of Python in Bill and Ted, which was just that we didn't have much money. He had made that movie for very little money, Holy Grail. And we thought, well, he'll design this like that. I mean, it was like I was shaking when I met him, I remember, just because of the connection that he had had with him. I remember going to see Python at the Hollywood Bowl, sitting way in the back, and weirdly, I got up to go get some popcorn. I remember it was popcorn, too. And there was a moment where Cleese came out to the audience for some reason. I don't even remember what. And we were way in the back. You know, it was 79. I was 19. I couldn't afford anything other than the worst possible seats at the Hollywood Bowl.
Sure.
I think there were $5. And that was a stretch for me. And I came out to get popcorn. And there was John Cleese. And there was a crowd forming. And the crowd forced me like a little bit of a surge right into him. So I was I was bumped into him. Had the opportunity to meet Cleese once, brought up this moment. Mm-hmm. He joked and said something, oh, that was you that got in the way, or like that annoyed me. I'm burying the big lead here that I probably didn't tell you. Ultimately, he's my father-in-law. He became my father-in-law.
I did not know
that. He's the grandfather of my kids. So the irony of the whole thing is, on one level, these two men influenced my comedy
and your life
in a very specific way, and that my dad's like joy and watching comedy was one of the things that brought me into comedy. Suddenly Python becomes this group that I'm like astounded by. Python became an influence for those first short films I was making. It was an influence in Bill and Ted, and then of course my dad and John Cleese are the two grandfathers to my two children now. So it's kind of a funny, ironic, blend. But
how, I have to ask, because this happens to no one that I know, how do you even process that? To I mean, obviously, if you, I have had the fortune to meet people I've admired, never on that level of familiarity or intimacy. But the idea that this, you know, this actual legend is part of your life, and that you, I mean, did you just corner him and ask him questions over and over again? Did you
I have never, except for a couple of passing conversations,
really
had these conversations with him. I'm very close with him. I really love him.
He, sure.
I was at, I'm no longer married to his daughter, but we've remained close. In fact, I was at his 80th birthday party last week in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
My girlfriend and her son and I went. He's very close with my kids. John is. I've never wanted that, to be honest, to be part of my relationship with him. It sounds strange, but
I mean, you're both writers, if nothing else.
We've talked about writing. We've talked about our work. We've talked about, what are you working on? What are you working on? I've asked him a few questions here and there, but and he knows. I told him, hey man, I was a giant fan of Python, but I don't think I went beyond that. Fawlty Towers is one of the best, I think, best paradigms for farce in the English language,
and, and the sitcom as it was, it's, yeah, there's stuff about it that's dated, but the mechanics of it are just, yeah,
it's remarkable. It took about 6 weeks to write each. He wrote six early and then was divorced. And Connie is my kid's grandmother.
Huh?
And Cynthia is the daughter of John and Connie. Connie co-wrote Fawlty Towers, and
yep,
she played Polly, the
yep,
maid.
Yep.
And Cynthia grew up on the set of that, you know. And so even when Cynthia was sick, you know, in home sometimes, and she doesn't have a super close relationship with her dad right now, or her parents. They're not, for whatever reason, as in touch.
Sure.
And but even in the darkest times of that, when she was sick, she used to watch Fawlty Towers, which she would say was the only time growing up, because they got divorced between the first and the second season, mm-hmm, of Fawlty Towers, which were a few years apart from each other. She talked about that as like a chance to see her parents happy together, a chance to see her parents doing something they both loved, a chance to see them parents making each other laugh. And she would sit on the floor and watch Fawlty Towers when we were married and just laugh and laugh. And it was a beautiful thing to watch, actually. How people who, they really loved what each other could do for each other. I'm talking about John and Connie, mm-hmm, in the making of that. And I think you can see it. They worked, you know, as a couple on it, created it, wrote it together, started it. It's kind of cool. But yeah, no, I've tried really hard I've tried really hard to have my relationship with John be a familial relationship and not about work. And we did work together briefly on a couple things, but one of them was a coincidental, which is I was consulting on a sitcom that a friend of mine had created. I was just doing a one day a week, and it turns out he was going to be a guest star, but there was no connection to that. So we ended up having a meeting. The writers had to meet with him to talk about his character, and I was working on that one day, so I was a part of that. It was kind of coincidental. And one time he did a voice for us in something. We made an animated, Chris Matheson and I, my partner on Bill and Ted, he and I wrote a ridiculous animated movie that we never could get made. It made us laugh so much. We worked our ass off on it. We believed in it so much that we spent our own money to hire people to do a recording. It's animated, and we thought, well, if we record this, we'll have our, if we get actors and we gave it to various people, and we got the most unbelievable cast assembled, all who read the script, and we spent our own money and we recorded the whole thing. And then we thought, it's kind of like doing an animated film on spec. And then we'll go to the market and we should be able to get this thing set up anywhere. And it was Jack Black and John C. Reilly doing the two main characters called automatons, which, mm-hmm, is, there were these insecure robots built in World War II to get Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini. They were shipped off their submarine sank, the project was abandoned, they were presumed gone, but they'd been wandering the bottom of the ocean for like 50 years, and the process, the pressure, the salt, who knows, made them really insecure. And when they emerge at the mouth of the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, St. Paul. They emerge still thinking they're going to get Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini. It turns out Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini have frozen themselves and are now trying to win back love to repent for their mistakes by putting on a production. They wanted to put on a production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, but they didn't have the rights. So they were denied the rights. So they wrote their own production called You're a Very Good Boy, Charlie Blue, and were putting it on in a community theater in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And the whole story was so absurd. But we had Gary Shandling did a voice, Fred Armisen, we had Rachel Dratch, we had Chris Parnell, and we had for Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini, Tojo was Fred Armisen, Mussolini with Sylvester Stallone, and John Cleese did Hitler, which was surreal in and of itself. Stallone recorded on his own, because he didn't want to record in a group, so he did the Mussolini stuff, and then Armisen and Cleese did Tojo and Hitler around Stallone's performance. It's some of the strangest, most surreal, most hilarious stuff. Anyway,
How has Netflix not picked
this? How has nobody picked it up? Yeah. Not one person ever picked it. There was no Netflix at the time.
Oh, but now there is.
By the way.
You still have the recording, I hope.
We do have the recording.
All right, we'll get it.
You know, it's funny. I tweeted about this and Project once. I was just mentioning something. I don't remember how it came up. And we did get a call from someone saying, hey, what about doing it here? It was Adult Swim. And I thought, we could probably do that. But I can't really reassemble the cast anymore. And their deal with them was such that it wouldn't be... We can't just... suddenly now sell it. But what I do have is the strangest, most strangely, what's the word? Not curated, but well, I had this experience. I probably, hardest I've ever laughed in my life. Chris and I were sitting on the floor of the Four Seasons in LA where Cleese was staying. Me and Chris and Fred Armisen went to go see Cleese to sort of meet and see if this would all work. And Fred and John riffing for, I don't even know, 45 minutes. I never recorded it. God, I should have recorded it. I was it was the funniest, and Armisen in particular, but John was funny too, obviously. But like the guys just riffing as Hitler and Tojo and for this private little performance, mm-hmm. I felt, you know, how lucky am I? I get to like have this experience nobody is having, and no one ever will again because it's gone.
Yeah.
We didn't even record it. But these recordings that we did, I know, I feel like I witnessed this. We had a week. We recorded it over the course of a week. And I feel like I witnessed this very strange iteration of this film that no one will ever see, that was a comedic high point for me. Billy Bob Thornton was in it, Holly Hunter, Catherine O'Hara.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no, it was incredible. But it's, you know, it's too weird. We brought it to every studio, and they're like, we can't you have Hitler in this. We can't possibly do it. They're doing this terrible performance where they've written terrible music and terrible lyrics and terrible acting. And we did it. We wanted to do it stop motion. In fact, we actually made 4 demos of the stop motion, but recording it ourselves using our own voices. Mm-hmm. We spent all this time and money. We believed in it so much. Nothing happened with it, except that I had my own private, strange comedy experience that was wonderful, but gone.
That's remarkable.
But the thing about Python that was so invigorating was you can be really brilliant and do ostensibly silly things, and it can have a lot of value, you know, if you're just following your own voice, you know. It's funny, I have seen him talk about Python because we went to see him in Vegas, and he did a performance where he talks about that stuff. So most of my knowledge of that is just public knowledge, or
And it's one of those things where there are just it's the Beatles, it's Kids in the Hall, right? It's the alignment of the sensibilities and the point where, yes, with Python, you generally know who wrote what. They're very specific about breaking that down.
Yeah.
Eric Idle on Conan O'Brien's podcast just the other day just jokingly said, oh, I wrote with myself. Casually taking credit for whatever it is he wrote.
Right.
But it's Palin and Jones, and it's Cleese and Chapman, and it's the animations from Gilliam, and just the way that in Holy Grail, it really does. Like, I think Life of Brian is probably the perfect version of their sensibility, just because Holy Grail doesn't really have an ending in the same way that Life of Brian does. Like, just that it has a musical number that really brings everything together. But Holy Grail is like watching them all fight for the steering wheel. You're just swinging through sensibilities and at such a speed that it really doesn't matter who's in charge at any given moment. You know, like Chapman, just by virtue of playing one character effectively in both films, sort of becomes the leading man. But it could just as easily have been, I mean, I think Jones could have played Arthur. I think Palin could have probably played Arthur. Cleese as well, but Cleese is almost by virtue of being so tall would be wrong for King Arthur.
Right.
He would have too much status. Chapman makes him question his authority, or constantly makes us question whether or not the guy deserves to be king.
Right.
He can't count to five, or can't count to three, I feel it. That is just, and then growing up and watching it over and over again, coming back to it as an adult, and realizing that that monologue, Dennis's monologue about an anarcho-syndicalist commune, that's actually not just made up. All of that theory is not only applicable, but actually...
Those guys were brilliant. Cleese was a lawyer. They were, I mean, they're all brilliant, brilliant, brilliant people. It speaks to what you're just saying about the group thing. It, you know, Kids in the Hall, SNL, Python, you name it. Look at Nichols and May.
Mm-hmm.
When people are starting and forming their points of view, very rarely does being a solo flyer really help. So often, I would say it's more often than not, and maybe almost all the time, except for some exceptions. Look at Woody Allen with Mel Brooks and the Sid and you know your show of shows. Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, Mel Tolkien, Woody Allen, Larry Gelbart are all writers on your show of shows. Having a group of people where you can you know fist fight with creatively, where you challenge each other, where you criticize each other, where you compete with each other, where you support each other, where you make each other laugh and then you make each other mad, and all those things are very formative and I think really important. And I always tell, like I teach a class when I can at NYU in writing, and I try as much as I can to talk to young people about it, and it helps me and more than it helps them probably. But one of the things I'm always saying is find groups that challenge you, find groups that, you know, you are both like-minded but also not. Find the right blend of people where you can push and push and push. And I think that, you know, without those groups, you know, it's that magic synergy. You know, you work with these people, you meet another, they challenge, you push, you move on to the next thing. People are always thinking, especially younger people, I need to network. You know, and they always think networking is meeting producers or meeting agents or meeting executives. To me, networking is about finding like-minded creative souls that are peers of yours, that you can rise with, that you can fight with, that you can grow with. That's the networking that's important. If you do that and you just keep following your creative vision, at the end of the day, people end up coming to you because you're creating the doorway for yourself to go through, as opposed to waiting for a gatekeeper to open a doorway for you. You're just making doors. It's like in Blazing Saddles, that great scene where it's like they're in the middle of the desert and they got to come up with a way to stop them. And they say, well, let's put up a toll. And they put up a toll booth in the middle of the desert and they go, we got to go back and get a whole shitload of dimes. But in a way, what's to me brilliant about that is it's like, they're just going, we're going to be the gate. We're just putting up a gate. That's not really the best metaphor. Okay, I take it back.
I can sort of see it, though. I mean, it is true that no one was going to make Python except themselves. Their humor was, I mean, Beyond the Fringe was there. There was a precedent for this sort of intellectual absurdism. But it isn't until you get the shouting that it becomes Python, I think. Like, if there's this undercurrent of repression and aggression that they brought to British comedy that hadn't existed before, I don't think.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, Spike Milligan was doing ridiculous things. Peter Sellers was doing precise character stuff. But it isn't until you see the Gumbies, or it isn't until the Upper Class Tour of the Year, those ideas where there's rage underneath and there's anger and it's completely entitled anger, I don't even know that they understood it. But ultimately, Holy Grail is about a king wandering around helpless, useless, trying to find this prize, which is ultimately meaningless.
Right.
Because God told him to. And it's just, I think it's just how they're telling...
Well, Life of Brian is a guy, you know, it's like, it's not me, you know.
Exactly. The literal son of God is two doors over. And we're stuck with this guy. And that was their joke from the very beginning. Like, what if we watch this one? But it's about people trying to claim power that they don't have or don't deserve. And in Life of Brian, they just reverse it by having him run away from it all.
Right.
And having everyone else insist that his nonsensical sayings mean something. And this sense of, I think this is where I first really understood what atheism was with Python.
Yeah.
Because everything is meaningless. Authority will not help you. And when God shows up, he's angry and useless. I mean, the aliens in Life of Brian... It's just such a... It apparently was just a coin flip, effectively, of, well, how do we get him out of this?
Right.
I don't know, flying saucer.
And then, well, that's the thing when you're doing that. We did this on Gary Shandling Show a lot. You laugh yourself into a corner, and you don't know how to get yourself out.
Yeah.
And it forces you to come up with something. And when it was working for us on It's Gary Shandling Show, we would write ourselves in... We, like the Python guys, we didn't have a lot of supervision... which is, I think, personally, a great way to make comedy. You have somebody who trusts you and gives you an outlet, but doesn't tell you what to do. Fantastic. Nobody was watching our show, so nobody seemed to care. We would write ourselves into a corner and run out of money or run out of story ideas, and we'd be stuck, and now suddenly... we've literally written ourselves into a corner. We're in the corner of the stage. We don't have another set we can create. How do we get him out? We'll have him break the fourth wall and walk across the front. Or we can't afford an actual airplane set. Let's just build a paper airplane and call this the airplane. Wait a minute. Why don't we just do that? And when it's going well, the critics would be like, well done. They're breaking the standards. But what they didn't realize when we were on the critic side was... Which is not on purpose. This is just people who are trying to laugh, who suddenly realize that it's 3 a.m. and if we don't have a script by 5 a.m., we have nothing to shoot to get printed. What are we going to do? And we stumbled through it that way, I think, with Python as well.
But that's part of it, right? Because if you trust your intuition, or you have no choice but to trust your intuition, you're going to do the thing that you want to do. Like, it's an act of creation that is... valid because it's being created, but also the desperation, I think, makes us want to believe in it. There was a moment in It's Gary Shandling Show that I've never forgotten. It's the scene where something goes missing on set, and Gary notices it and talks to the audience and just says, I think, I can't remember what it was, a wallet or something.
I don't remember.
It's really
either.
Something basic. But it's, you know, like, or a watch or a wallet, and he just says, you know, like, I'm going to turn around and whoever took it, just put it back. It's fine. It's going to be fine. And someone comes out of the audience and replaces the item, and security guards swoop in and grab him. And the joke for me is that you can't trust Gary Shandling. And it's so great. It's like, it's the moral fabric of the world is maintained, but it was done through a trick.
Well, Shandling Show, I learned a ton about writing and a ton about the internal physics of a show. Of something, and what makes something work and what makes something not work. At least, what are your better odds at making something work versus not work? And on Gary Shandling's show, what we learned, and it's different than like Holy Grail, which is really a series of set pieces,
you
know, conceived to make people laugh, to make each other laugh.
Sketches within a rough framework of, you know, 1932 AD, but up until the very end.
We'll say that again?
Well, up until the very end of Holy Grail, when it's just...
Right.
Yeah. Pure anarchy of the present.
Yeah.
But, Shandling was...
But, and before I get into the Shandling, what I would also say, one last thing about the Python thing, which made it so appealing, and it relates to the Shandling thing, and in a way, is in my own experience, was also... relates to the creation of Bill and Ted, which I'll get to in a second.
Yeah.
And that is... the divining rod was what makes us laugh, and going toward that. And I think there's something not just infectious about that, but actually true about what makes people attracted to something. It's not because it fits into a formula of what has already been done or expected. And this is what I hate about screenwriting books, that they tell you a movie has to be this. Right. This is the, and people try to write movies by hitting this on X on page 10 and Y on page 20 and Z on page 30. And it's like, it's so wrong. You're just creating these Frankenstein monsters of the script. When in fact, what you're really looking for, what people are really responding to, is a voice, originality, a voice, somebody expressing something that is unique to them. And what happens is, when you do that, if you get it so that it's actually flying, but it's your own voice, other people turn and go, what is that? And yeah. They follow it. And that's what happened, I think, with Python. When things were working on Shanley Show, and this was the point I was getting to about the physics, when it was working, we didn't have to worry about making it fit into anything. We found our rhythm. The thing that I learned about that was, because we were breaking the fourth wall and we were doing all sorts of things that theoretically weren't, they'd been done, but not in a popular way. And not that we were popular, because nobody saw it. But I found that shows that we created that were based on the physics of the show, like we had an idea for a gimmick and then we tried to retrofit a story into it, they never worked. But stories that had genuine emotional truth, that were about something real, that we then would create, we would then write, and then the ideas, the bizarre premises, strange gimmicks, breaking the fourth wall, walking out in front of the set, or whatever, talking the way he would talk to the audience and whatever, those things would fall into place naturally, and the shows always worked better. My favorite of the Gary Shandling shows was, a lot of people won't know what the show is. Basically, Gary Shandling Show was a show about a guy named Gary Shandling, played by Gary Shandling, who has a TV show called It's Gary Shandling Show that he runs out of his living room, that was a set that was basically based on Gary's actual living room. But the basic premise was, he's running a show called It's Gary Shandling Show out of his living room, and nobody else knows that it's a TV show except him, which gives him a special relationship with the audience. My favorite episode.
The audience, which is present, for those of you who haven't seen it. There is an actual
studio. Oh, there's a studio audience. And, right, exactly. Which is
just something I'd never seen before. The acknowledgement of the audience, the fact right. that you were watching this sort of relationship.
Well, this episode was very much about that. It was an episode I wrote with Tom Gamble and Max Prost, two brilliant, brilliant, brilliant guys that are still on Simpsons now, did Seinfeld, they were on SNL before. And talk about groups of people that just, man, Mike and Al, who were also on Simpsons, Tom and Max, there was like a series of comedy writers who could get to places that I could never get to and will never be able to get to. But having the opportunity to work with people like that, you know, helped flex my own muscles, but made me really appreciate just how brilliant people like that are. Anyway, I had this idea for this episode, and we had to write it really fast. So Tom and Max and I all wrote it together. The premise was, Gary's best friend, Schumacher, I'm forgetting his name, but Grant is the kid. Grant is this kid, is Gary's, like, not really nephew, it's his best friend's son. Grant, Grant wins a poetry competition. He wrote a poetry competition, and the prize was a trip to Hollywood for the family. Now, they live in Sherman Oaks, which is, you know, just over the hill from Hollywood. So the Schumacher, this episode's called The Schumachers Go to Hollywood. So Grant and his family are going to go to Hollywood to have a trip. Meanwhile, Gary is charged with feeding Grant's fish while Grant's away. So the Schumachers go to Hollywood, but again, the Schumachers go to Hollywood and they have to drive to Hollywood from Sherman Oaks. And now they're on Hollywood Boulevard and they're looking around and someone's handing out tickets to a television show. And they go, hey, what if we go to Uncle Gary's show? We'll go to It's Gary Shandling Show. And they're like, oh, what a good idea. So the Schumachers have to then drive, you know, to the set, even though the set of Hollywood Boulevard is on the stage of the show itself. And the studio audience is watching the Schumachers. Then they go, well, now we have to drive. So they get into their car And then there's footage of them driving. They pull up outside the stage, and they have to now enter through the, they come in through the back of the audience and come down to watch the show. While, and now they're sitting in the audience. Now they're watching the show, and Gary's on stage. And Gary, they come in during the scene where Gary is feeding Grant's fish. And they're like, oh, it's Grant, you know, it's my, you know. And he's feeding the fish, and he finds the poem that Grant had written that won him the award. And it's a love poem to this girl named Lily Wu. And Gary reads the poem out loud that Grant had written. And it humiliates Grant, and he's livid. And so Grant and the family are pissed at Gary, but they can't leap off the stage and go onto the set because the physics won't allow that, of the internal physics of the show itself.
Yeah, of course.
They have to get in their car and drive all the way back and storm into the to Gary's apartment because they couldn't obviously break that. And the audience, even though technically they were 6 feet away from Gary, had they done that, it would have broken a contract in a weird way between the, you know, viewer and the, but that was my favorite episode because it was an emotional story that was kind of true, but it used the physics in a way that to me was the most fun.
Well, I mean, it acknowledges it, or rather it forces the show to acknowledge just how weird and artificial everything is in a way that it couldn't before.
But it keeps the audience in on the artificiality,
right,
so that everyone is in on the same joke and everyone is playing along, everyone is sharing the same understandings. And you would have known. I mean, if they had leapt over the balcony, the whole show would have imploded.
Yeah, because the audience has never done, other than the shoplifting moment, the audience has never done that. There's not that kind of access available to those of us who are watching, who are those of us in the room, in the audience on the TV.
Right.
Watching on TV.
Well, I don't know. Like, I don't remember the shoplift, like this, the thing being stolen. I just don't. Maybe I didn't work on it because I didn't all work. I worked for the first three seasons, but I worked on and off because Bill and Ted was getting made as well. So I left sometimes and came back. So
it was like the very last moment of an episode. That's where the credits roll with the guy being escorted off by security. But it's just genius.
Wow.
But and the thing that this that Gary Shandling's and Bill and Ted's and Python all have in common are the is people describe them all as whimsical, which I think means that we are, I mean, whimsical has a lot of different meanings depending on who's saying it and who hears it, but I think for this usage, what it means is that we're invited to share the play. Like, we're allowed to experience the same joy the writers have in crafting this stuff. We are in on the jokes of Python in a way that we're in on the jokes of Gary Shandling's show, and just, you know, water loops.
Right.
Is such, I saw that, I saw a whole audience take a second, it reverberated through the room as they all figured it out. That joke is layered and set up, and we get to feel how much fun it was for you two to come up with it.
Well, I'm gonna shatter your dreams here.
No.
I believe water loops was Steve Herrick's notion, the joke of water loops itself, calling it water loops because of Napoleon.
Right, yeah.
That was actually not our joke. We wouldn't have done that. I would not have called it that, actually. We actually called it Raging Waters, which is what it was, but Raging Waters wouldn't give us the rights. So it was actually Steve Herrick who said, how about Waterloops? Because it's a play on Waterloo. And we were like, okay.
But that's such a where would he go? Waterloops. It's just so beautiful. My God. So
I can't take credit for that.
So the material itself generated the joke.
So, yeah, Steve did. I mean, Steve was responsible for it being a phone booth. We had it was a van. And then Back to the Future came out. And they were like, it's too much like Back to the Future. So Steve changed it to a phone booth, which I wish we had pushed back harder on. It's too much like Doctor Who. I didn't know Doctor Who at the time.
Well,
we didn't have, there wasn't the internet. There was, you know.
It was in a lull at that time anyway.
Yeah. Look, we were like teenage or the early 20s people in LA in the early 80s creating this thing, and we weren't aware of Doctor Who. I'm embarrassed to say. I wish I had been. I don't know how I would have been, but I wish I had been because I wouldn't have done a phone booth. It's too much like the TARDIS.
Yeah.
But having said that, what is the same is not the level of humor or anything, but the act of creating it in a way that makes you laugh, that only makes you laugh. And Bill and Ted was created out of me, Chris Matheson, our friend Ryan Rowe, Mark Sandarowski, and Mark Jaffe, the five of us. And Mark's a comedian and a comedy writer in Cleveland now. Mark Sandarowski is a director. He directs television. He's an amazing TV director. Ryan Rose, a writer as well. Chris is, you know, Chris is also a writer. But at the time, we were 21, 22, 23, and we were, you know, like me, these guys all worshipped the altar of comedy. We wanted to push ourselves. We wanted to expand. And so we rented a theater for $20 a night. It's called the Gardner Stage. I don't know if it still exists. On Sunset and Gardner in Hollywood. I think it was Monday, so they were dark that night. $20. We just used the stage. And we'd work out doing stand-up. I'm not stand-up, improv.
But the characters were.
Yeah.
Well, but we weren't even trying. Like, we never had an audience. We didn't want an audience. And we weren't trying, even though we're all writers, we weren't trying to create characters or come up with ideas for movies. It wasn't about showcasing ourselves. It was about purely pushing ourselves comedically. And for sure, Python was an influence to us, as were some of the other absurdist, you know, things that seemed to break barriers. And all we would do is just like throw out ideas and go for it and try to improv stuff and just make shit up without paying any attention to what happens with it. We never recorded anything ever. I wish to God we had now, because we did it for years. Who knows what passed through that yeah, we yeah. have no, I have no memory of almost all of it. But how Bill and Ted came up was one random moment in one random evening. I remember Matheson saying, let's do two guys who know nothing about history, studying about history. I was like, okay. And he called me Ted. I called him Bill. And Ryan was there. He was Bob. Mark was Mr. Williams, who was originally Ted's original last name, his father. And there was Rufus, who was Mark Jaffe, who for some reason was a 27-year-old high school sophomore that was also there. And we just fucked around doing Bill and Ted. And Chris and I enjoyed that a lot. So that night we went to a coffee shop and continued just doing Bill and Ted with each other. And then over the course of a year, just messed around as Bill and Ted sometimes. Never doing them in a sketch again, but just together. Or we'd write letters sometimes as Bill and Ted, or just do the guys because they were so much fun to do. And a year later, we wanted to do another influence, Kentucky Fried Movie.
Oh, yeah.
Style movie, The Zuckers. You know, it was like Python, series of sketches. We wanted to do a sketch movie, and we wrote about 8 or 10 sketches for this movie. One was Automatons, which became that thing, Automatons, which we wrote 20 years later to be Automatons, which still exists, but no one will ever see. And Bill and Ted were characters in a 7-minute sketch. And it was Chris's father, months and months later, when Chris and I decided, what if we wrote an actual movie? What would the actual movie be? And it was Chris's father who said, you know, I always thought you should expand. And Chris's father is a very noted science fiction writer.
Oh, I know. Yeah, Richard Matheson.
Richard Matheson,
yeah. Legend. The inventor accidentally of the modern zombie, basically, because we never relied on the book.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, absolutely. I mean, Richard Matheson was a visionary and, you know, influenced people like Stephen King and, you know. But Richard said, well, that Bill and Ted, those two guys, why don't you consider making that into a full-length movie? And we're like, could we do that? And then we just started throwing ideas around and trying to make each other laugh. Same reason. We had no idea that people would end up seeing it. I remember Chris looking across the diner from me, looking up while we were writing and going, somebody could even read this. We might get people to read this script. But all we wanted to do was just push ourselves and make each other laugh and make ourselves laugh. And that's what we did. And the characters became the script, but the characters emerged out of a group of people just trying to make each other laugh without regard to doing something with it.
Right.
It's that let's do something with it thing that changes it all. It becomes Schrodinger's cat all of a sudden, as opposed to a pure experiment, you know?
Yeah. Actually, and that's an excellent way of putting it, because as soon as you decide this is going to be looked at, right, by someone
else, it changes it all. It changes it, makes you subconscious. And it's funny because for two guys, me and Chris, who both wanted to be writers, both wanted to be comedy writers, it never crossed our mind to turn them into characters in a movie or a sketch show or anything for a year. Never. And I'm really glad it didn't. I'm really glad. I think I made a lot of career mistakes. I made a lot of creative mistakes. I made a lot of personal mistakes in my life. I don't regret the way we went about that period of life comedically and just trying to get better. Now, I'll never... So, actually, ironically, back to something we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
We've got the script. I gave it to my agents. I was 23. My agents at the time hated it. I remember there's an actual, I remember this very clearly. I'm talking to an agent. He goes, I am begging you not to send the script. Do you hear this? I mean, hear the sound like that. That's me falling to my knees, begging you to not send the script out. It's like, holy shit. And I was like, Chris, I don't know what we're going to do. We got to like, they don't like it, you know? It's like, all right, I know what to do. I'm going to go in and I'm going to rally the troops. I'm going to get them, you know. And he drive. We go in his car. He has a Persimmon Carmen Ghia. And we drive into the parking structure. He stays in the garage. I go, I'm going to go up. I'm going to do my thing. I'd arranged the meeting. There's five agents in the conference room. This is the big meeting with this client who had a Laverne and Shirley TV job and showed promise, but struggled writing a script, wrote another screenplay. I had written an earlier script that they had liked. It's not a very good script, honestly. And now I've got this other script that I seem to really believe in, and they're trying to figure out, what are we going to do with this client? Are we going to... And my objective is to rally them into getting behind it. And it becomes one of those, like if it was a scene from a movie, that the score would be swelling.
Right.
There'd be a beat forming as I'm going, and you know, I got to tell you something. I believe in this. And if you don't believe in this, maybe you're not the right people to represent me. And maybe we should go our own separate ways. And because I really think this is funny. And in fact, I think, and blah, 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 blah. And silence, silence. Then one of the agents says, well, then maybe you should go your own way. And the other agents go, yeah, maybe we're not the people for you. And I go back to him. He's like, how'd it go? And I'm like, we don't have agents. I was like, oh, shit. And I have the script. Nobody will admit. I was out of money. I had borrowed money from my parents. I thought my Laverne and Shirley job was a flash in the pan. Because I, you know, that job had gotten... through my, I'd gotten freshman year or senior year of college. I was like, I guess that's it for my writing career. And then thankfully an agent read it who I had met a year and a half earlier. Hey, would you mind reading this? And he liked, and you know, it ended up connecting. It got set up, and it took years of development and all that, where we almost destroyed it so many different ways, different times. Ended up going back to a very close iteration to what it originally was, thankfully, luckily. Yeah, but what we were trying to do was Python. We were trying to... I didn't like the Bill and Ted movie when it first was finished because it was too polished for me, even though, in hindsight, I haven't really seen it much. I've only seen it three times total in my life. The one recent time was when we did a DVD commentary for a Blu-ray release, and I hadn't seen it in 20 years, probably at least. I saw it when a screening and on opening day, and then I never saw it again. Bogus Journey, same. I saw it twice. And the second time was for the DVD
right.
commentary, which made for an interesting commentary because I hadn't seen it in so long. But I was really disappointed seeing it the first time because it didn't seem like a Python film. It seemed like a movie, like a regular movie, that was a very watered down and sort of cleaner version than we had expected. Ours was more raucous and rough-edged, in my mind.
Right.
In hindsight, I'm very proud of the movie. In fact, I'm the most proud of that, of anything probably that I've done, only because it has a spirit that transcended its mistakes. And there are a lot of mistakes, and there are things in that movie I regret. And there were things in that movie that I wish weren't in there a lot. But overall, the generosity of spirit of it, as embodied by Alex and Keanu, who are wonderful and great guys, by the way, and great partners on this new movie and great friends. Good. I'm not friends with Keanu. We're friendly and we work together, and I've worked on quite a few things with him. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't call us personal, like friends outside of the work. Mm-hmm. I like him a ton, though, and I respect him a lot. Alex and I have become good friends just because we kept hanging out, and then also worked together really hard on getting this third movie made. So he and I have become friends. But I feel like I've been rambling.
No, it's all, but it's all.
It's all part of it.
It is, really. And what I was going to, I mean.
If anyone's still listening, sorry.
Someone is always still listening. We have the numbers on this. What I was going to say is the last question on the podcast is always the same, which I think we've more or less covered, but it's, you know, what of Holy Grail have you used? Have you cannibalized? Have you assimilated into your own creative personality, your sensibility, your DNA? Where can you point to something that you've done and say that's where Holy Grail shines through, or is it more just an attitude and an aesthetic?
Oh yeah, and this is where I was going with the story I was about to say, which is then when Bill and Ted got set up, we became the flavor of the month for a little while. We go to meeting after meeting. The voice in the script apparently seemed somewhat unique. The script seemed, it was doing our job. We suddenly were getting these job offers and all this stuff. People would always say, what do you want to do? I want to be Python. I've never become Python. I would never have become Python. It served only as an aspiration for me to push myself. I will never hit that. It's like the rabbit, you know, the greyhound chasing the metal rabbit. Yeah. On the earth. I will never catch it. I will never, and that's okay. I got depressed for a while. Like, I'll never be able to do that. I don't have the chops for that. I have the chops to keep pushing myself. I did have the foresight to try to keep strengthening some of my weaknesses. But comedy, you can get proficient. But if you're not a genius, you can't get to where those people can get to. And I'm not a genius. I'm good enough to work my skills, to be able to get stuff to work for the most part by the end of the process, hopefully, but not always. In other words, and comedy is hard, and it's hard to do as an adult, as you get older. It's a young person's game, not for the reasons that I think people think it is, which is the culture. The comedy is all contextual, it's all context, mm-hmm. in my opinion. The you had to be there thing is actually true. It doesn't mean it wasn't funny then. It means it was contextually funny.
Yeah, combination of elements. It's
yes,
the people, the time, the sensibility. Absolutely,
100%. And it's the audience and the expectation of the audience. You know, Python. When you go to see a Python movie, they built a brand. If Holy Grail came out without the show, probably nobody. They would have gone, what the hell is this? But because they'd already built up the sense of a relationship with its audience, people were open and accepting of it. I wanted to be that. But what I was going to say about as you get older, what happens is, I mean, the best I could do was work with a great friend, Chris, on Bill and Ted. Laugh like crazy. Writing it, work on Gary Shandling with great people and laugh working on it. Even Men in Black, I could laugh working on it, but by then even, I'm in my early 30s, early mid-30s, I knew that I couldn't lean on my comedy chops for much longer because it's not just that the culture changes, it's that you as an adult change. Even though you can appreciate, I laugh more in my life now than I probably laughed ever. I love my life more. I appreciate comedy a lot. I still do. I love nothing. I have such a weak spot for people that really make me laugh. Mm-hmm. But I knew about 20 years ago that if I don't start to grow my skills into other areas, I'll be the most pathetic of all creatures, which is an aging comedy writer. And there's nothing worse, man, than like somebody who's not quite funny or can't quite get there who is still trying.
Yeah, still insisting on it.
Yeah, and it's sad and it's hard. However, that was my driving force. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be, you know, Python, Woody Allen. If it was music, I wanted to be Springsteen, Dylan. I never was. I never will, but I'm looking back going, you know, but I have a career that has had ups and downs, a lot of downs, but enough ups that I've, you know, the tent, there's enough poles in the tent that the tent's up and providing some shelter, you know.
Sure.
I'm still growing as a writer. I'm still working. I'm working on probably some of my most interesting things, certainly with some of the best people I've ever worked with, on projects that are really fascinating to me. And though I didn't carve that path out that I originally thought, Python was, along with Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, some of the, you know, some of those 70s, because that was my formative year, 70s visionaries that were breaking rules and stuff. But they at least provided inspiration for what is possible. And that rabbit, for me, is that greyhound to chase that I'll, that, you know. So to me, that's how they influenced me. And the funny thing is, my personal relationship aside, they probably had the biggest comedic influence on my life. And, you know, as you get older, you realize that we're all different. And, you know, I used to get really depressed that I'm never going to be able to do that. I'm never going to achieve that. But then gradually it's like, yeah, you know, you achieve what... You do the best work you can do.
Yeah.
You work as hard as you can.
I'm listening to you say this and it's like, okay, yes, true, but Python never came up with be excellent to each other.
Which but they is came like, up with other stuff.
But it's equally valid, I think, and resonant to I mean, I was going to say a generation of people who grew up watching it, and I was already in my 20s when I saw Bill and Ted, but I've never forgotten that. That's, you know, heartwarming and also genuinely inspirational. And Python teaches you not to trust authority. Bill and Ted teaches you to actually try to be a good person.
Well, I appreciate that. Python's an
Please
entire...
tell me that you guys came up with it. It wasn't something Steve Herrick came up with.
No, we were at the coffee shop. I remember that moment exactly when it came up, which was we did not expect that to be a big thing. We actually... So we'd written the script, and initially it was... Rufus was still a 27-year-old sophomore who had a van that inexplicably, meaning we never explained it, drove through time. Mm-hmm. And he was going to take them through time to help them with their history test with their van and this dog named Dog Rufus. And I think Rufus was actually a stoner. Bill and Ted never are stoners, even though people think they are, but they aren't.
Right.
They never did drugs or anything like that. Certainly not by the time we were writing them into a movie. But we had no framework. And then for their trip traveling, and it was just, there was something missing. So I remember going, hey, what if it turns out that in the future, their music, it's not just about them separating, but what if in the future, as a joke, their music is what saves the world? And so maybe someone comes from the, maybe Rufus comes from the future. So that was the, we rewrote.
Right.
And we're sitting there sitting there at Ships in Westwood. Well, this might have been Ships on La Cienega by that time. The Westwood might have been closed by then, but we're at Ships. And we were saying, well, what do they say when they get to the future? And we just said, be excellent to each other. I don't remember which of us said it. And party on, dudes. And then we just kept writing. Like, we didn't stop to think, that's it. That's great. We just like, of course, that's what they would say. And to me, that is a product of just knowing these characters. We weren't trying to say something wise. However, if my entire career ends today, because of this podcast, which is very possible. And I've created nothing else, and I've added nothing to the culture. Just having been part of a group that put Be Excellent to Each Other out there would have made it worthwhile.
I think so, too.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you.
Not at all.
My thanks to Ed Solomon, whose new film, Bill and Ted Face the Music, will be in theaters and on demand this Friday, August 28th. Please try to see it in the safest possible circumstances. Thanks also to Gwen Hyman and Andrew Carmelini. They know what they did. You can find Ed on Twitter at Ed_Solomon, and you can find Monty Python and the Holy Grail on Blu-ray and DVD from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. It's also available on Apple TV and Google Play, and streaming on Netflix in both the US and Canada. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner, and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where I'm hosting a bunch of podcasts these days in addition to writing about movies and television. You can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. They're good too. Stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out. And seriously, be excellent to each other. I'll see you next time.